So, first of all, thank you also for being available for this interview with for Here Now TV. And I was made aware of you by an email, but I already had heard or seen of you on that Buddha at the Gas Pump.
Oh, yeah.
So that's another one. And we are working very much the same style. At least I am working very much the same style. I don't have a video camera, so I'm using Skype, which saves also traveling efforts. Yeah? And it's beautiful to use this technology for such conversations.
It's amazing. Yeah.
It's almost like we were sitting in the same room, as you said, in the short pre-communication that we had. One can feel the energy. Mm-hmm.
That's even our experience in terms of working with people, because we really only started using the internet on a regular basis less than a year ago. And, you know, I'm an old man, so I had my reservations. And I thought, this cannot be as effective as sitting across from each other in the same room. But I was wrong. It actually is really the same. It actually has the same effectiveness, the same power. People have actually told me I feel a strong transmission even on the internet. So it works.
Yeah.
Es läuft.
Es läuft. Es funktioniert. Yeah. Yeah. So you are calling yourself in your videos. I've watched a few. Bodhisattva Sri Swami Premodaya. Please explain
enough.
This.
Enough. Well, there's a long, long tradition of people who do this kind of work having many different names. And there are, it's actually very interesting. It's a very interesting point. There are, well, let me start from the beginning. I've been doing this almost 9 years. And one of the things that I've seen is there are thresholds along the way where the work changes. It's not a decision you make. It's not, really, I look at it as God changes the work. And when that happens, you don't know what the nature of the change is. You have a sense that, okay, now it's going to change, but it unfolds and then you find out what it is. And usually that takes a month or two. And there is a really interesting and valid reason to mark that with a name change. So originally I was Swami Premodaya. Then I added at a certain point where it changed dramatically to where much, much more was required of me. And basically I had to give up everything. Basically what was required at that point, and I don't know, maybe that was 3-4 years into it. What was required is that this become my whole life. That service is the only thing going on. And you kind of have to retire from everything else. So at that point, I added the Bodhisattva because it means that I'm required to give my life in service to others. So it was appropriate to indicate that. It also works as something that gives a message to the people who are attracted to you or that God wants to send. And, you know, I can't explain every aspect of it. There's a mystical aspect of it. And then thirdly, we added the Shri not that long ago, and a couple of years ago, when the work changed again. And that was kind of a little bit reference and homage to my master Osho. So, but it's also, it marked a change in the work. I think in the time that I've been doing this work, it's been maybe 4 or 5 changes like that. Half of them have been just a change, nothing dramatic, but 2 or 3 of them have been very dramatic changes in the work to where I experience it differently, the effect is different, and just the whole nature of it changes. And, you know, you can't know this ahead of time. There's no handbook for spiritual teachers, so that, you know, it's you learn as you go, and you're amazed by how everything gets taken care of. So I don't know if that's a real answer, but that's the true answer.
To me, that sounds reasonable. I mean,
I don't know if it makes sense, but it makes sense to me. So
it makes also sense to me because there's very, very much less control than we normally believe, or the whole life is driven by something.
Reinhold, that's my entire teaching right there. That's my entire teaching. And that's the part that people seem to have the most trouble with. They want to cling to some kind of notion or even slim idea that you get to control something. And I keep telling them in a very, very, as often and as authoritatively and as strongly as I can, that you don't have any control over anything. Nothing, nothing. If you could prove that you can make one hair on your head grow 1 millimeter, if you could show or you felt that you controlled 1/10 of one heartbeat, then yeah, we can talk about control. But nobody can prove that. Nobody can say that. And I don't see how people can argue that you have control. What happens is they get mental about it. They start to think of it as cause and effect. You know what I mean? They start to think, okay, well, I decided to move to Germany instead of to China, so of course I have control. You don't know the origin of those decisions. You don't know everything that's involved with it. You don't know how that came to be your preference. And to call it control is simply fooling yourself. I mean, I really am an advocate that the more you accept, realize, and see for yourself that you control absolutely nothing, the better off you are. I think you look on your face, I think you agree with me.
That's exactly my experience.
Yeah, but this is not most people's experience. Even sincere spiritual seekers, very intelligent people, and understand many things, but this idea of control is very, very difficult for people. They don't seem to want to really accept that there really is no control for a human being. And I think they don't get that there's nothing to lose. If you actually see that, and you actually live it, and you actually accept it, and you actually see the truth of it, I think people, before they see it, they think, I'll lose something if I really accept that. And what they can't see is you actually don't lose anything. What a relief, and more. Even you gain much. So because then you're more open to the universal understanding.
There's no limitation by thoughts, expectations, and fears. That's it.
All of that. Hey, I can retire. You can do my job. Yeah.
Yeah, my job is at the moment. I don't know if I should give myself a name for that. I would not even know which name. Yeah. When we come back to the discussion about the names, it's just.
Well, I didn't give myself the name Swami Premadaya. That's from my beloved master Osho.
Okay. So he called you Swami Premadaya.
Premadaya.
What does
all male disciples of Osho were referred to as Swami. Osho did amazingly, amazingly provocative and there's a word, but I can't think what it is. Anyway, Swami is a traditional term, in Hinduism for monks, for people who have actually taken a monastic training, who have studied the ancient texts, and who actually, very much like graduate school in the West, have had to go through a very rigorous testing procedure. Swami basically means you have a PhD in Hinduism. And that's a very ancient term and a very ancient system. And Osho did something amazingly radical, which is everyone who came to him and asked and was given discipleship immediately was referred to as Swami. Without the training, I mean, they could be the biggest idiot in the world, and they're still Swami. Now, in Hinduism, if somebody says, oh, Swami so-and-so is coming, that has meaning. That means that person has proven themselves in a certain way. They have gone through a certain traditional training that has a very ancient lineage. And in a sense, they have credentials. What Osho did is he gave everybody who came to him instant credentials. So
okay.
That's Osho's, anti-establishment mindset, I think. He says, okay, I'll take this. It says, in Christianity, somebody is called reverend. And it's like it's as if Osho had said, okay, everybody who's my disciple, you are now Reverend Reinhold.
So what does Premodaya then mean?
Love arising.
Okay.
So, when your guru gives you a new name, it is a indicator of your path. So giving me that name is Osho telling me that just move more and more into love. Let love rise more and more in you.
So that was the program for you, the path, a description of the path at that time.
No, it's an indicator. It's one of many things. I mean, you could say it that way, but.
How long did you spend with Osho? How long did you stay where, in India or in the U.S.? Or?
No, in the U.S., but if you ask, are you asking how much time did I spend with Osho in the same room, or how much time did I spend with Osho as his devotee?
Did you live with him in a commune, or did you?
No. I was a visitor. I visited as often as I could, because we didn't live that far away. I was in graduate school at the time, and we would go as often as we could, which wasn't as often as I would have liked. But you have to understand, the genuine guru-disciple relationship has nothing to do with space and time. So, sure, it's wonderful to be in the presence of your master. It's wonderful to spend time. It's wonderful to be able to commune, but it's the same. There's a benefit in it. There's an advantage in it, but it's not essentially about that. It's essentially about the nature of the relationship, which is a divinely given relationship from the way I look at it.
Could you try to describe this relationship for me? And
yeah, absolutely. From both sides, from the side of disciple, mm-hmm. and from the side of the guru. The relationship is the only relationship people will ever experience that is different from all other relationships. It's absolutely unique. A, it's divinely given. B, it is not a decision. My experience of it and the way I try to explain it to people is God gives you your guru and God gives the guru the disciple. It's mutually given. God puts you together. And there is a mystical set of circumstances that gets created by that. That mystical set of circumstances is designed to benefit the disciple. And to the degree that the disciple is open to the master, willing for the master, surrenders to the master, trusts the master, loves the master, and cultivates or naturally arises devotion to the master, that download, so to speak, can happen more. And that's why all the talk and all the traditions where there's a guru figure of devotion and trust, because it's the effect of devotion and trust that makes the disciple open to receiving from the master. But receiving from the master is a divine occurrence. In essence, the master is the vehicle, and what's being transmitted is God. It's the simplest way to say it.
Can you give me a description of God? How would you describe God?
What I generally end up saying is God is all and the everything, all together, all at once. Which, you know, my view of things is the Advaita view, which is there's only one. There's only one thing going on, ever. It's all one. It's all one thing. But even when you say it's all one thing, you've already said too much. It's better to say all one. Better than saying it's all one, it's just saying one. So everything is the divine itself. So you name it, that's God.
Okay, then you say the relationship between the guru and the disciple is somehow established by
God. It's God-given. It's God-given.
It's God-given, yeah. So like everything else.
Like everything else, but it operates differently than everything else. Because for most of us, we can see a similarity between our different types of experiences and different types of relationships that are in the world. So family relationships is one type of worldly relationship. Love relationships, romantic relationships is one kind of worldly relationship. Friendships, acquaintanceships, social relationships is one kind of worldly relationship. Work relationships, your colleagues, your boss is one set of worldly relationships. We tend to operate along basic implied rules, kind of general set of rules that underlie all those relationships, and then there are specific conventions and rules for each category of relationships. The only person you will ever meet in your life where none of those apply is the guru, because the guru is the only person you will ever relate to who actually has no agenda and has no agenda for their relationship with you. In every other relationship, even if it's loving and wonderful and couldn't be, even if it has a divine aspect, there's still an agenda going on. There's still some kind of transaction. There's still some kind of, if you do this, I'll do that. There's still some kind of reciprocity. In the guru, the thing that's unique about the guru-disciple relationship is that's the only relationship where that doesn't exist. The guru exists only to serve the disciple. So the guru has no personal agenda, and the guru really has no agenda for the disciple other than to help them go as far as they can go, as fast as they can go. I mean, I look at my job as to take people to God as much, as far and as quickly as they're willing. So, but that's not really an agenda. That's just the purpose of my life. So the purpose of what I'm supposed to do.
When you see truth, this is clear. You cannot do other.
You're saying that, or you're asking me? Are you saying that?
I believe I'm saying that and asking you at the same time. Yeah, sure.
Well, in my case, it was a mission that was assigned to me, and to my great amazement. And luckily, it was assigned by the time I was mature enough that I didn't question it much or argue with it. If it had come when I was younger, I think I would have argued and said, really? No.
Can I do that? Can I take this responsibility, or in another way?
No, that was there for 2 seconds. That was there. It was more amazement, like, you've got to be kidding me. You know, I'm the last person in the world. But I think everybody feels that. No, in the sense of it's just practical. At the point that came, I was really at the pinnacle of my career in psychology. I had achieved a certain status, and for the first time in my life, I was making really good money. And, you know, I had never thought much about money. It didn't matter much to me. But I was getting older, and I had not one dime set aside for retirement or anything. And for the last few years before that, I'd actually been doing very well. Money was pouring in. I had a lot of money in the bank. And basically, God comes along and says, quit all that and do this instead, and be a spiritual teacher instead, which means I have to give up my income. So
that's a tough one, though.
Well, I didn't like the idea, but like I said, I was mature enough at that point that I wouldn't be so foolish as to argue with God. So I did certainly wonder about it, like, how can this be, and why would people come to me, you know? But they did, from the beginning, they did. And it's God brings the people. It's as simple as that. So I don't... My job is to make myself available. That's actually the mission that I was given. God said, make yourself available to people spiritually. So I'm worldly enough. I had enough business experience and worldly experience and life experience to know that I can't just sit there and put the sign out on the front door saying, you know, available for people spiritually. I have to somehow advertise, somehow make a system so that I can work with people. So we started a center in Los Angeles and did all the standard things that spiritual teachers do to get the word out and to advertise and to let people know you're available. And it all worked. So that kind of proved to me that it's true. God wants me to do this, because from the beginning people came. So that was really my criteria. In the back of my mind, I was saying, we'll see what happens at the first event. If nobody shows up, I'm going to just forget the whole thing. But the first event, many people came, and it went very well, and it all worked.
So did you get this message to act as a guru, or as a, make yourself available in a vision or in a dream, or how did that work?
No, a series of events is very strange. In a series of events, it became it all went in a certain direction. Even though I was working in hospital administration and psychology and psychiatric program management, I was never willing to give up working with people directly. My love is people. I don't care about any of the people. So I would always work with people, which people who were in my position really didn't do. So I was always looked at a little bit funny that I still would meet with patients. And at a certain point, it just very clearly changed. The people I was working with, instead of coming to the session from the last session and reporting a psychological breakthrough or an emotional insight or some kind of clarity about their life or their problem, they started reporting almost exclusively spiritual experiences and spiritual breakthroughs and insights having to do with the nature of existence. And this had never happened before, never. And so the first person, when it was like that, I didn't think much of it, okay. But then the next person the same, the next person the same, the next person the same. And it just started being in my life all the time. Then I would be walking, there was one instance where I was walking down the street and a person just looked in my eyes and ran over and stopped me and looked close to me and said, "I need help and I think you're the one who can help me." And I said, "What do you mean?" They said, "I need spiritual help, and I think you're the one to help me." And that started things like that started happening, and that turned out to be quite amazing. That was a person who was on the verge of suicide for spiritual reasons, spiritual confusion, spiritual intensity that they didn't know what it was about. And I did work with that man, and he's having a wonderful life now, and he's very spiritually aware now. Anyway, those things became common for a period of many months, and I had to. It'd be stupid not for me to take notice. I said, what's going on here? And once I started to question it, and I really wasn't coming up with any answers other than, this is very strange, you know, my whole career I've done psychological work, and suddenly my psychological work seems to be spiritual work. I mean, I'm not doing anything different, but the person is experiencing something different that's more spiritual. And I thought about that, you know, not for long, maybe for a day. And then at a certain point, I just had an inner knowing. Not God spoke to me in a loud voice. But it was clear to me, this is God speaking to me. And it's exactly what I told you is what the message was. Now you have to make yourself available to people spiritually. Exactly those words. And that's it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I can't explain it. I can just tell you as candidly as I know how that that's what happened. So.
Suddenly a knowing.
Yeah, no, that it was definitely God speaking to me. I don't have any doubt about it.
Yeah, it's somehow it. To me, this sounds like a sudden knowing in my terminology. I mean, when we define God as everything there is, then suddenly there is a crystallization into this. With that respect or something like that. Yeah.
I would never disagree with that characterization, but for me personally, when if I were to say a kind of a knowing, it's almost too individual, too personal. It sounds like I know something, you know. Whereas what I'm trying to convey, it was literally kind of an order from God. Like, I don't care if you like it or not, I don't care if you want to or not, you have to do this now. You know. So it was a direct order. So my job is to be a good soldier and follow orders. You know. Really, you seem to have an amazing, really, really developed understanding of all this that I don't run across very often. It's really a pleasure.
Thank you. Again, I fell into this also by I don't know what. Yeah? So one can call it God, probably. And it started on that path. I stumbled across a book, and in the end of the day, somehow...
What book? Now you got me curious. What book?
Very traditional. There is a Jesuit called Franz Jalic who wrote a book about how to meditate. It's 400 pages. And in a very nice structure. So he has divided the steps into 10 times, so to say, and for each time he gives a reference to his personal biography. He gives an explanation about the methodology that is learned gives a little bit of background to Christianity and tells how to what to do. That 10 days, he also offers retreats, the duration of 10 days. And then it is written in a way that you can do it on your own. And there is a lot of psychology in it, because in every time, day, so to say, he has certain dialogues between the master of this retreat and the disciple, with typical addressing typical problems that occur.
Wonderful. But yeah, the Jesuits are the true mystics of Christianity. So
I don't know. So I stepped into that. Yeah, I stepped into that one, and I did it on my own when my wife and my family was not with me, and I had a week of vacation. And that started things rolling.
Absolutely wonderful. Yeah, that was no accident.
Now I say no. It was kind of the
how long ago was that?
That was in 2004.
Oh, so my God. Recently.
Yeah.
Yeah, not 20 or 30 years ago. Yeah. Wonderful.
Yeah, that was
wonderful. You've moved recently. Quickly. You're fast.
I don't move at all. I cannot see that I ever moved.
You accepted a great deal quickly and readily. That's for sure.
Yeah, that was one step, and then 4 years later, my wife said, "Maybe you are mature to go to a retreat to these Jesuit guys." Yeah? And right at the beginning, there came a moment of total surrender. Yeah. And that is somehow, if one could call it, guru disciple thing. Yeah, the disciple just has to surrender. The disciple has to trust blindly. Yeah, I can see this clear now. Yeah? So when you say that a guru is very helpful, and the disciple has just to surrender, because from where he stands, he cannot see. He cannot see where he is moving. So surrender to a guru who really knows what it is about is a very important step. And
it's essential. But but what people don't understand is surrender really amounts to, now you're making yourself really available. You're making yourself fertile ground for what can be given. If people understood that more clearly, they'd have an easier time with this idea of surrender. But it's very difficult for people to – people wrestle with this word surrender, with this concept of surrender. They find it so foreign and so complex, they just can't get their hands around it.
I can give you the sentence that made me surrender. Maybe this is helpful for the people who see this also. That was said on the first or second evening of that retreat. It was a silent retreat, and this Jesuit person, it was not the one who had written the book. I had met that person also personally, but the personal relationship between me and that guy was not in the foreground. But the master of that retreat said, God, here I am. And now you do whatever you wish. This is where we are home. And then I sense suddenly fear. Now everything is at stake. Then I said, okay, now I'm here, and now I go for it. All in, like in poker, all in. And then there was a night of sleep.
So beautiful.
And then the next morning, things started rolling. visions and bliss, and in the end of the day, several days of total reorganization. Then came laughing. Because it was seen that I had believed I had any control in the past, but I could see after this, there was never any control.
And so wonderful.
Also, being judgmental doesn't make sense. The divine is in everything. So fundamentally, the picture that you gave about God is what I could experience, or what was experienced through this.
And that's another thing that confuses people. And I find very often that my job is to help people not have this be a barrier. they have an experience like what you're describing, either fully or partially. They have some taste of that. Something happens for them that's real, and they know it's real. And then they get the idea that the proof is that you have to be experiencing this all the time for the rest of your life, for 24 hours a day. 24 hours a day, 60 minutes an hour, every moment permanently. Somehow I've lost it. Somehow I'm not there unless I'm experiencing that powerful, intense experience that I had right now. And it's very hard with some people to get them to see that if you experienced it for 1 second, that's enough. You have to make that enough because you saw something and you know something for sure that most people never get to know, never get to see the truth of it. And if you go running after, and you had such intense bliss, now you're just running after the bliss. And that's not what
No. Yeah, that's not.
Yeah. No, I'm saying this is what happens for, I notice for so many people, and my heart goes out to them, then I have to do everything I can to get them to see that the gift has already been given. You know, if the gift is a chocolate cake, you don't have to be eating cake the rest of your life. You know, now you know what chocolate cake is, and that's what it's about. It has to go into your understanding, and you have to stand on it, and you have to live from it. You have to make it the center of what you know. And because it's just so common. I never knew this till I sat in a guru chair, but it's just so common. So many people have this experience and then have the incorrect idea that it's not valid unless I feel this way, if not all the time, at least frequently. And then I do whatever I can to persuade them that that's completely not the case.
I can confirm this totally. Yes. Yeah, this is first. Yeah. It is not necessary. You see the truth, or you see part of it, and when you look inside, and then the work started fundamentally, because then I knew the direction, yeah, and that was about 4 years ago, yeah. And then I returned home, and one thing which I changed immediately, I wasn't no longer judgmental about people, yeah. So that was the starting point, yeah, and I said, no, this is bullshit, and don't be judgmental because the divine is in them. That I had seen clearly. Yeah.
Yes.
So I'm not better than him. He is not worse than me. I have good intentions. Probably he also has good intentions. If he has not good intentions, probably it's just confusion. Yeah. So that's fundamentally then what happened. Yeah. But there was still a lot of, and still is probably, a lot of structures in the nervous system and the body, and I cannot even describe what it is. Yeah, when there was still ideas and beliefs, and somehow as it has come with a relationship between me and God, somehow still this duality was running. Yeah, even though there was God and everybody underneath God or so. Yeah. So this duality was still running. So, and I was lost. I was alone. And then I looked into the internet and found these Advaita teachers. And they are talking about something which feels true. And then a year later, a trauma was seen. With the assistance of a coach in that Jesuit tradition. That was a bodily experience, pain in every cell, fundamentally, and terrible. Yeah? And much longer than I had sensed. She told me recently that it had an duration of 20 minutes. And I had believed maybe 30 seconds or so, but it was terrible. But I knew at that time already that feel this pain. Yeah? Don't go away. Don't try to suppress it. Go into it. Go through it. Yeah? And then suddenly it was seen, behind this pain there was a thought. There was just a thought. And nothing outside, but inside me. The thought was the source of the pain. And then I started understanding these mechanisms. So then the cleaning work or sorting out things work started. And this was not always blissful. So these bliss states, they came sometimes, there was a stage when I said, no, I have to get rid of that also. Leave it behind. Don't even be attached to that.
Because you can't control it. You don't know what's coming tomorrow.
Yeah, exactly. So it
and a human life includes everything. It includes bliss and it includes pain. And it includes, you know, wonderful states of pleasure and difficult states of displeasure. So.
Yeah. Yeah, and then, yeah, I don't know.
Well, I still say you've moved very quickly, very quickly. Good for you. It just means you were willing for it. It just means you were willing to accept and not make it into a resistance or prove it to me. You know, you took the proofs and accepted
them. Yes.
So,
yes.
And that's wisdom. Good for you. That's 90% of my work is trying to help people relax a little bit more and not resist so much and not worry so much and you know, just really let the process take them. So you surrender to the master, so you can it's preparation to surrender to the divine process itself. That's what you're describing. How a human being experiences the divine process.
Yeah, that's an example. One example.
Yes.
Probably everybody has different experiences. Yeah, and
well,
even the experiences
different, but in general, pretty similar. In general, it's one experience, but it has different flavors for different people and different nuances and different specifics, but not that different. Generally, you know, there's some kind of experience of tremendous fear and tremendous trepidation and a tremendous feeling of overwhelm. And I think it, you know, the particulars, the specifics work very similar for most people because it's a real occurrence. It's something that it's an actual process. It's not imagined. It's an actual process, and actual processes tend to be this similar for most people. So, you know, I mean, if 20 people take an airplane trip, even though each one will have a little bit different experience, they'll have, in general, a similar experience of what it's like to take the same airplane trip or even different airplane trips. It's like that. So, you know, you might have a better airline, a worse airline. You might have a prettier stewardess or not so pretty stewardess. But if you're flying, you're flying. It has the same flavor in general. And the spiritual, the coming to the spiritual path itself, I think, is the same. So
okay.
I see a lot of differences for people. The differences are in the pre-stage. The differences is once it really is happening, I think it's similar for people. How they got there is very different for different people, and how long they resist it, and how long they deny it, and how much they, the different games people play with the journey towards the journey. So, those are very different for different people.
Now, what I can see as a common ground that has to be gone through is just seeing through the nonsense of any belief. Yeah? So that's the bottom line from my experience in the end. Yeah. So any belief, anything that you try to hold on.
Well, you have to completely, you can have beliefs, but you have to stop believing in beliefs. If you don't believe your own beliefs, then there's no problem. But you know, I mean, I talk about this all the time with people that, and particularly in larger groups, that the spiritual path is real, and therefore it has certain requirements. Those requirements operate as thresholds. So it's exactly what you're saying, but I'm just expanding on it.
Please.
Certain things must occur for you to be able to go forward, for the process to go forward, and until and unless they occur, there's no going forward in a significant sense. And another aspect is, you know, the imagination, the mind is very, very powerful. People can fool themselves that they're on a spiritual path who aren't anywhere near any real spiritual path. So these thresholds operate as markers that demonstrate basically both to the person and to others the path they're on is the real spiritual path. My way of looking at it is there's only one spiritual path. There's many different forms of it. There's one true, real spiritual path, and no matter what the tradition or no matter what the person's experience or no matter how it's characterized, certain thresholds have to be passed through. Certain things have to take place for it to proceed. And what you're describing is one of them. One of them is that every person is absolutely required to get to the point where they see the non-significance and non-reality of human beliefs, which goes against most Western culture, which says it's very important to believe and it's very important to choose something and believe in it. You know, it's the exact opposite. So it's very, very you know, revolutionary in that sense. It goes against what the culture teaches and insists on.
Yeah, even the churches, yeah. I mean, they talk about beliefs all the time.
Yeah, yeah.
So, ironically, I ran into this through an organization that points into the opposite direction. Yeah. It's totally crazy. I mean,
yeah, but it's for somebody who hasn't climbed out of it even a little bit, it's impossible to see. It's impossible. I mean, there has to come that first moment, that first ray of recognition that maybe beliefs aren't what I think they are. And until that happens, you are completely, completely lost in the same. You are unable to see the nature of beliefs and why that is a bush of thorns, you know. So that's why you can't explain this to people. You can only explain it. You can only have a conversation to the degree that the other person has experienced it. But if you're speaking with someone who has not experienced it at all, they'll just think you're crazy or stupid.
I know. I make this experience many times. So. Yeah, but what can I do? I mean, there are some who get it. Yeah. So yeah. At least
the plants and I, if it's a more conventional person who can't, you know, has no experience of this, then you can hope that at least a seed has been planted, a seed of doubt that maybe there is, maybe beliefs aren't what I think they are, and maybe in 10 years they'll come to something.
Exactly, yeah, that's what I hope sometimes, and but some people who are, I don't know, I cannot even qualify them because I'm just lacking the experience, but some guys really see it. Yeah, there was one guy who had a burnout.
Oh, almost. If they're ready, it'll be our explosion.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly, that happened.
Everything will just turn inside.
Yeah. Yeah. So seeing through the nature of beliefs, so you say, is one threshold. What are the other thresholds, or does it make sense to speak about these thresholds at all? Or
it makes sense, yeah. Well, I speak about them all the time, but why it makes sense to speak about them is because people have to hear that, because, you know, spirituality in the 21st century is very influenced by New Age concepts. Whether you like it or don't like it, it's true. And one of the, to me, a little bit the essence of a New Age way of thinking is kind of anything goes, that nothing really has to be a certain way. That's one way of characterizing it. Another way is that find your own truth. You know, that's, it's all very individual. You make your own spiritual path. And, you know, that's so Komisch to me. When I hear that, you know, well, I found my truth. There's no my truth. Either it's the truth or it's not the truth. And if it's my truth, it's not the truth, because the truth, the truth, and it stands on its own feet, and it doesn't belong to you, and you can't have one, and your wife has another one, and your friend has another one, and there aren't takes on the truth, there's just the truth. So, but this is very common in New Age thinking and New Age, the influence of New Age ideas on people, and they don't realize, they don't really, you know, unfortunately don't get it, that it's completely ego. It's just going down the ego road and saying that it's, you know, that it's somehow spiritual. And that's what the importance of talking about, to me, that's the importance of talking about these thresholds, because it is the demonstration, the explanation, the proof that not only is a spiritual path real, true, an actual thing, but that it has actual requirements, the same way as, you know, driving from Germany to Russia, there are certain borders you have to pass through, and if you didn't pass through those borders, if this is your route and you didn't pass through those borders, you're not on your way to Russia. You may think you are, but actually you're on your way to Norway, you know, so you're going the wrong way. So people have to understand how easy it is to go the wrong way. And it is the job of the guru, if somebody comes to him and allows it, to point out to someone, you're going to Norway. You're going the wrong way. This is not correct, and you have to change it. And here's the right way. So the thresholds simply are ways to speak to people about this is how to understand the requirements. The requirements are real. And the requirements are the proofs in terms of kind of what stage you pass through. And if this requirement hasn't been met, if this threshold hasn't been crossed, if this stage hasn't happened for you yet, then don't fool yourself that it has, and don't fool yourself that you're on the 10th floor when you're only on the 5th floor. Because there's nothing wrong with the 5th floor, and there's nothing, somebody who's on the 10th floor isn't better than you, like you were saying. There's no judgment in it. It's just saying understand where you are, understand what you're dealing with. Don't have the idea that you're in China when you're in Russia. And you have to understand the landscape. And the guru many times is performing the function of explaining the landscape so that people can kind of have a, their bearings, you know, their sea legs. So, that's one threshold. Another threshold is this whole that you have to at some point develop an understanding, and for some it happens earlier and for some it happens later. This is more, you know, can happen at different points. There are some that have to happen at a certain point or else you can't go forward. There has to occur some kind of real personal understanding, direct seeing, really, really grasping it, what this thing ego really is. And so many times people talk about ego, and in so many groups people talk about ego, and not everybody is really understanding what that means. It's very important if the spiritual path is, if you want to be in spiritual life for real and be on a real spiritual path, that you have gotten to the point where this is at least intelligible to you and you grasp the essence of it, that there is a function going on in you that is self-deceptive, and that is very, very subtle, and that operates to keep you away from truth, away from God, instead of, if your purpose is to go toward God, you have to both understand and be able to deal with this thing called ego, because it will fool you every time. So that's another one of the important thresholds. You already talked about one of the most essential, most significant thresholds, which is the willingness to surrender, the willingness to fire yourself as the final authority on everything. Because most people are walking around in life with the unconscious idea that they are the final authority on everything. Even if they know that they don't know anything about a subject, and even if they're talking to an expert, the idea in the back of their mind is, well, but I get to decide finally how I view it. You know, I'm the final authority for me. And this is also very difficult for most of us to accept, and first to see and then to accept. And it can happen the other way around. It's even good if you can accept it before you've seen it, that maybe you are not the final authority on everything. And maybe you are not even, surprisingly, the final authority on yourself. So,
yeah. Okay.
Well, those are a few. Those are a few of the thresholds. I could think of more, but, you know, that gives the idea of what I'm trying to express. So, but until a person has, and this is a real struggle for me, I had real difficulty with this concept of ego early. It took me years and years, and you know, I really didn't get what people were talking about. And then one day, it was just clear. One day, suddenly I understood it. So, and until that day happens, until you have a working understanding of how your own ego is preventing you, is holding you back, and is fooling you, then it is impossible to not be fooled. Then you are going to fall into traps all along. If you keep going forward, you're not really going forward because you keep falling into traps that the ego is creating that divert you. And this is what's so difficult for people to accept from the guru, because the guru is the only one who's really going to tell you straight out that, hey, you're fooling yourself. This is not true what you think is going on. You have fallen into a trap, and that's just what's going on. The person thinks they've achieved something. What you're really doing is you're trying to convince them that what they see as an achievement is not an achievement. It's self-deception, and nobody likes that. Nobody likes to be told that. So the guru has to be as skillful as they can in helping people and how they give that message and how they help people to try to accept it. So sometimes you have to be a little tricky.
Okay.
you can't usually tell a person straight out, hey, you're just fooling yourself. And you know, a person can come and report an experience. I've had the deepest experience of God I've ever had. I have seen God's face. I have been completely transformed. And the guru, you know, this happens all the time. And the guru knows from the nature, from what he sees in the person, and from the nature of how the person is reporting it, that this is completely delusional. The person has just imagined all of this. The ego has tricked them into believing they've had this transformative, powerful experience. Well, it's usually not going to work with most people, for the even disciples, but especially non-disciples, for the guru to say, well, sorry, it's completely incorrect. You're fooling yourself. Your ego has gotten the better of you, and you have not seen God at all. And actually, for you to continue to focus on this and to believe that that's what's happened is actually harmful to you, is actually going to prevent you from progressing. So nobody wants to hear that. And, you know, if it's a disciple, that's often when they leave the guru. They don't want to have their bubble burst, you know. So the guru has to be pretty skillful, crafty, you know how to say how much and how to say to different people so that they can get a little bit of it at a time usually. And that's where if you really trust the guru, if you've developed and cultivated real trust, real devotion in the guru, then the guru can tell you straight out, because you're not going to say they're against you, they're critical, or that they've hurt your feelings. That won't be your experience. The guru is simply telling you accurately, and you go, and you're grateful. You say, oh, thank you. I thought I had this great experience. Instead, apparently, I fooled myself. But anything short of that, if there isn't enough devotion, if there isn't enough trust, if the person doesn't have the right attitude toward the guru, they're gonna feel like the guru is criticizing them or trying to take their best thing in life away from them, or the guru's gone crazy, the guru doesn't know what he's talking about, you know, anything.
Yeah, but what I experienced as a very valuable period, yeah, and still, yeah, as soon as something gets tense and resistance arises inside, no matter where it comes from, if it comes from somebody who says something to me or some feeling, then it gets interesting, yeah, because... Mm-hmm. Every time there was a structure in me, and I was very curious about looking into what drives this resistance. So the recommendation would be look into this apparently bad situations and states of mind and of the system, and investigate what happens there. And then a guru can tell you what he wants you, then it will be taken gratefully. And even then the guru is everybody, starts to be everybody, the wife, for example.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, the universe is, I think most people who are in spiritual life have had this experience over and over, that the universe is really quite kind. And if there's something you really need to know, it gives you the message from every direction, you know.
Yes.
Whether you like it or not.
So instead of resisting, the recommendation is going into it, towards it.
Yeah, but I really, you know, people when, you know, I mean, I'm a working guru, so people who come to me, and I think who go to any spiritual master to be worked with, use this term resistance, I think, too quickly. It's real resistance is not going on all the time. What is going on all the time is the process or the work of moving forward, the work of having to let something go, or the work of having to see something differently or understand in a more true way. And that doesn't always happen in a split second. So I think many times people call it resistance when what they're actually they're in a way being too hard on themselves, too self-critical, because what's actually going on is they're simply going through the necessary time period and the necessary inner experiences and inner transformations for the new understanding to come about. And I think people in spiritual life who are, you know, real sincere spiritual seekers frequently call this resistance right away in their own mind and how they speak about it. And it's my observation that many times I wouldn't call it resistance. I would call it as, hey, the process is just happening for you. Just wait and see. Because there is real resistance. Real resistance is when you actually refuse. Real resistance is when you're not just struggling with it, but you're actually, you know, powerfully, strongly trying to keep it out. It's not true. That's real resistance.
Or it is. But
even though you know it's so.
Do you notice that when, I believe we are talking about unconscious subjects also here, yeah? Then you might not even notice that you reject something. Yeah?
Well, I'm talking about the stage where you do notice. Yeah, you're right, but I'm talking about the stage where you do know, where there's a strong emotional reaction or some kind of inner reaction that says, I don't want this, this isn't true, this isn't for me, I've made a mistake, you know, they don't know what they're talking about. You know, that to me is the real resistance. And at that point, you are not just struggling with something. I think the struggle is fine. The struggle is part of the process and almost unavoidable. But at that point, you are not just struggling. You are trying your best to close the door. If you're lucky, you'll fail. And if you're not lucky, you may succeed in closing the door. And then you lose. Then you can't go forward, or it actually turns you away from the spiritual path or away from the evolution of your own understanding. But usually, my experience is usually, if it's real resistance, it really tends to go on for a goodly time period. So that's one way to try to assess.
Yes. It goes on. It may take some time, but this is the interesting phases in my experience. Yeah? And then I said, there is another one. So something is going on here. There is a belief it should be other than it is actually. And then the resistance, the negative emotion comes. Yeah? And then work on that. Yeah, look into it. Yeah. So go always again and again and again and again until you see what is behind. Yeah? And then.
Yeah. But this is where if God has given you a life where discipleship is involved and you actually do have a guru, this is where the guru can be so tremendously helpful and quickly take you forward, because the guru can just tell you, this isn't resistance, this is. And if it is, can tell you exactly what to do so that you can simply leave it behind rather than have to go through this struggle and go through all this fighting and this figuring out and this emotional roller coaster. The guru can, if the person has the right relationship, is open to the guru can actually save you all that wear and tear and just help you very quickly, in an hour or in a day, move to the next step. So there is really a benefit that's possible for the disciple, or even somebody who's not a disciple but is closely linked to the guru, that I think people aren't always aware of, unless and until they experience it, or if they've seen it in someone, if they've seen it happen with someone else, because these things are not things. I think what people often forget is, you don't have to go through these things alone. You don't have to move a mountain by yourself. There's always support. There's always help available. The universe is trying to help you. You know.
Can you give an example? What was the barrier, and what were the steps to get it resolved in an hour or so?
Mm-hmm.
How would that typically work?
Let me think. What's a clear one? Well, it can be very, very simple. Often the most common one is a complete misunderstanding on the part of the person. Which amounts to a false belief that they've convinced themselves of. Something I run across, this is coming to mind because I run across it so regularly. The person comes and says that the issue is trust. I really don't have enough trust. I don't trust God. You're my guru, but, you know, I'm trying to trust you more, but I notice there's many doubts. And at least, I don't know, I don't know if I can put a number on it. Probably 50%, at least 50% of the time or more, none of that is going on. There is no trust issue. There is no trust issue. The person is completely capable of trust. The person is even more capable of surrender than they have recognized so far. What's actually going on in the majority of those cases is the person has simply been seduced by their own natural doubt. The mind is a doubt factory. If we start from there, mm-hmm. The mind is a doubt factory, perfectly capable of creating doubt about anything at all. And in those cases, the person is believing or is perceiving it as I have a trust issue. Actually, they don't have a trust issue. They simply have been pulled into the loop of doubt so effectively by their own ego that it makes them question their own heart. It makes them question themselves. Now, if their trust and their devotion and their relationship with the guru is sufficient, the guru can simply point out to them, hey, there's no trust issue. Your trust is good enough for now. Your trust is sufficient for where we're at. Your devotion is sufficient. What's going on, and by the way, this becomes an object lesson. What's going on is your mind has tricked you through the mechanism of doubt into questioning yourself about things you don't need to question yourself about. And if the person has the trust in the guru, has the devotion to the guru, they will simply accept that in the moment right away. The beauty of the nature of that aspect of the guru-disciple relationship is the trusting disciple is able to apply it directly, immediately. In other words, it isn't an idea that they take and then they think about it and then it kind of seeps into their daily experience. They simply, they graft it onto their lives immediately. Mm-hmm. And that grafting means they get it completely instantly. And therefore, the false idea, oh, I have a trust issue, I'm not trusting enough, disappears because they see it isn't true. And they understand that there's an immediate comprehension of what's being explained about doubt. That all this is doubt, is your ego has effectively captured you with doubt. It's like a rope around you. All you have to do is take the rope off. Just don't cooperate with the doubt. Let the doubt be there. Let it try to convince you, but don't listen. So, and this happens all the time. That's one example. I could probably sit here all day and give you examples, but that's a good one because it's so common. So often the most loving, sincere, trusting, devoted people will come and say, I'm not devoted enough to you, or I need to be more loving. You know, and you're sitting there looking in the eyes of somebody that you've never met anybody more loving, and they're telling you how unloving they are. So if there's a real, you know, guru-disciple relationship going on where the trust on the disciple side is sufficient, the guru can just simply say, no, it's not true. Here's what's true. And the person walks away having gotten it entirely. Not just gotten it mentally, but it's now operating in their life.
A transmission.
It's instant. So it's just so beautiful that that's possible, that God made it that way, and it's, I think, every guru's wish and hope that more people can use it, can avail it, can open themselves enough where they can get the benefit of that. You know, it's like you can be training for a boxing match. You can train for 6 months running and skipping rope and punching a bag, or you can in 5 seconds be in condition. You know,
yeah.
So it's just I love when it's mystically instant. You know. So. This is what's hard for people in the West to understand, because they're, you know, the guru disciple phenomenon is not part of the culture. In various Eastern cultures, it's part of the culture. It's very hard for people to understand, and this goes back to what we were saying at the beginning. That's not like any other relationship you'll ever experience with other people. It's very hard for people to understand and to have a sense of, until they've really experienced it themselves, the benefits that are possible. The miracles that are possible. I mean, certainly, it couldn't be stated any other way that Osho's effect on my life was completely miraculous. I can't imagine any other way I could have gotten what I got except through the miracle of Osho, the miracle of the instantaneous transformation of it. So, and I'm just, I just can't believe it when I see people are using me that way, and that the credit goes to God, that somehow I can be used the same way. I can't imagine, but I see it so. So it's just incredible. It's just incredible. And even then, people can get confused. People can fall into the doubt trap. People can go all kinds of crazy ways, because, you know, we're all crazy and we're all full of nonsense, and the nonsense can take over. And a big part of the responsibility and the function of the guru is to protect you from your own nonsense. to help you climb out of it quicker or not fall into it in the first place. But that can't happen if you are trying to be your, you know, if you have a guru, the biggest mistake you can make is to at the same time try to be your own guru. Either you're going to listen to the guru or you're going to listen to yourself. If you don't have a guru, then fine, listen to yourself. But understand that when you're listening to yourself, all you're listening to is your own ego. And your ego is not your friend. Your ego is simply trying to tell you whatever it needs to tell you so that the ego can be in charge. The ego's whole pleasure, whole purpose in life, because the ego has a life, the ego's whole purpose is to be the decision maker for you, to control you, to be the one who gets their way. The ego's not interested in you having your way. The ego wants its way. Why it's so pernicious, so subtle, so amazingly complex, is the ego has convinced us, almost always, that the ego is us. So when the ego succeeds in getting its way, the person experiences it as they've gotten their way. But actually, they probably haven't. They've gotten the ego's way. If the ego wasn't there, if the ego was shut down or not functioning, whatever, the person actually, in most cases, might have chosen something very different or preferred something very different or liked or wanted something very different. But the trick of it is the ego has convinced you that it's you. And that's why I was saying the threshold, the requirement of being able to see the difference between you and your ego is so essential, because until then, you believe you are your own ego. What you're experiencing as you is really your experience of your ego. And what could be trickier than that? What could be more deceptive than that? That you think it's you, but it's actually the part of you that is not looking out for you. It's the part of you that's trying to lead you away from yourself. Because the more you are yourself, the more the ego can control you. And the more you have moved away from yourself, the more the ego is completely controlling you. So this is very hard to get until you understand what this thing ego is. And it's very hard to get until you've had some successful experience of beating the ego at its own game, of you getting to decide instead of the ego deciding for you. Are we getting too complicated?
I don't know.
Yeah, you know, I start talking and it just goes and goes.
It's always difficult to say. I just try to refer to my experiences. That's all that I have. And somehow what you said, what is the ego then? Yeah. So to me this seems, or your statements triggered something that it is related, maybe identical with the belief in being a separate individual.
Yes. Yeah. Ego is the part of you that truly, truly believes there's an I. If you're Premadaya, then ego is the part of you that really believes there's Premadaya. If you're Reinhold, then ego is the part of you that really, really believes that there's a Reinhold and that Reinhold should have it this way versus that way.
Yeah. So, okay, so we are on the same page here. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it is what it is. You know, it's a real thing. it's the same in everybody. It's the same in everybody. Just like eyes are eyes. Your eyes may be blue. My eyes may be brown. Somebody else's eyes are green. Somebody else, is black. Somebody else is white. But we all have eyes, and eyes are eyes. The ego is just another organ, another structure, another level. So.
Then the question comes, even that question does not make sense anymore. Who are we here? It just doesn't make sense.
Well, we are the ones who are trying to be who we really are instead of what the ego has convinced us of. It's one way to say it.
So who are we really?
Who are we really is this moment's experience of the all and the everything. This moment of God in this particular place and time, in this chair, in that chair, in every chair.
What I
Now that's the easy to talk about part. The more difficult to talk about characterization is the more universal way of experiencing it. So, you know, I can give you 88 answers to that question easily, or 1,088 answers. But how I generally talk about it with people is there's the personal aspect, which we're all very good at experiencing because we've all been trained to believe that's the real thing. And then there's the universal aspect, which is more what's really going on. And until you have just as much awareness and are just as comfortable noticing and experiencing more the universal aspect than the personal aspect, you are probably being, at least to some degree, fooled by your ego more than is good for you. So, but the answer to that question, who are we then? We are the universal, who don't always experience ourselves as the universal. And the job is to understand that as fully as possible, so that there is a involuntary awareness, a light goes on, that you don't control. You didn't turn the light on, but the light goes on that, hey, this is the universal. This, and Reinhold, just Reinhold, as he is, inside his skin, is the universal. Premadaya is the universal. Everything I see, everything I perceive, everything I touch is the universal. I'm just perceiving it in a personal form. I'm just seeing it not as it really is. And to the degree that I can see it more as it really is, I'm better off, I think. I think you're better off. But to develop the eyes for the universal, to be able to see the universal in everything is, if you say, who are we? We are the ones who are trying to see the universal in everything. Sometimes we fail, sometimes we succeed. What do you think?
Okay. Yeah, I'm just trying to take this one. What I saw, there is no separate, there is only the universal. Yeah?
Yes.
Yeah. So
I'm only talking about levels of understanding, because, you know, the levels are infinite. So when I say the personal, the universal, those are only two levels, and then the level, you know, you can talk about many levels, other levels, and the level I think that you're more keyed into is the level that's not very relevant. It doesn't even matter, the personal or universal, because the truth is what is, and that's who we are. We are what is. We are part of what is, or we are what is, or however you want to say it. But it's not practical for everyone or for most people. Most people, to get there, they have to understand it in the more limited. Yes. Oh, the personal and the universal. Most of us can't go from the personal directly to the divine, directly to what is. We kind of have to grow our understanding in stages, and then we have to let go of what we thought, now we understand, and move to a better understanding. And that's what the guru is always doing, either trying to pull you, or just take you by the hand to the better understanding. And then once you have that, say, oh, no, there's more. Let's keep going.
Yeah, I mean, but is finished. Yeah? And
yes, after that, but words don't express very well.
Yeah, it's just one example. I don't know if this works, if this is a nice one. Yeah. What I would phrase it sometimes is a movie is being played, yeah, so to say. But to whom? Yeah, this to whom? Yeah, cannot be grabbed at all. Yeah? There is just this movie.
Yes.
The perceiver and the perceived, there is no separation, but again, nobody will understand if he does not have this experience. So.
Well, no, you'll understand it more. You'll understand it more and more the more you're able to not be quite so serious about everything. This is why Osho talked endlessly about don't be so serious. If you get a little less serious, this will start to make sense to you. But if you insist on being so serious, this will never make sense. You'll just think it's crazy talk.
Yeah, when you have fixed reference points, you're lost. You're lost.
And it's fine to be lost, because we all start from lost. Nobody starts from found. We all start from lost. The question is, can you relax a little and be be a little more not so serious, that you can start to find and not be quite so lost, quite so insisting on being lost. And insisting on being lost all the time, insisting I'm not lost, you know.
Yeah. Okay, so how would you be available for Germans with your work?
Exactly how we're doing our work now. We are in the process, I'm happy to say, finally, of trying to convert, of converting everything that we have done on a face-to-face level. All our well, first of all, the easy, quick answer is come to a retreat, come to a weekend intensive. If you have to get on a plane because it's not in Germany, fine. But that's up to you. But all of those things, except for the 5-day retreats, are being converted to an online format. Some already are, and some are in process and will be online soon. So the first one I want to emphasize, is because it just never ceases to amaze me how it works, is we developed a training. We can't really call it a course because it's more an immersion. It's more intensive than that. It's called the Beyond Self Training. Don't get too stuck on that, because we're actually about to change the name of it for the online format. But that has been probably our most revolutionary single form for working with people in a group format that's easy, that doesn't require any, you know, huge commitment of changing your life somehow, or quitting your job, or getting on a plane and spending a month in India or whatever. And it's powerfully transformational. It has worked for the majority of people who have taken it in a way I never imagined when we developed it. So not yet, but very soon, that's going to be online. So I would recommend that as a very, very effective method for self-transformation that we offer. But the basic answer is, you can participate in everything online. We have online satsang on a regular basis. We have online public meetings all the time. We have online courses. And what would even be better is just invite me to Germany. So, Sie könnten mir einladen, ich will kommen.
Ja.
No, I would love to...
Are you still there?
I'm just thinking what my real feeling is. I would love to see German people plugging in more to the work that I do. It's just, there's something about, I don't know how to say it, I hope people don't take it wrong. There's something about Germans that it just feels right to me. And that's a positive statement. There's something about Germans who embrace spiritual life and kind of what their potential is, that the things we offer, I think, are would work well for Germans. They, you know, not everything works the same way for every kind of person and people of different cultural backgrounds. I think what we do works for most people, but there's just, maybe I'm trying to say I really have a love for Germans. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but there's just something about it, having grown up speaking German. But It's easy to plug into what we do. It's easy to get me no matter what country you're in. And the simplest way is just sign up for an online satsang. It's interactive. It's exactly like what we're doing. We can converse in real time, and it isn't just me giving a lecture and then you listen and decide whether you like it or not. You can ask anything you want, and my whole joy is working with people directly, working with people in a one-on-one moment where I can really do what I know to do, and let's see where we can get to. So, and I think Germans are maybe a little more open to that than some cultures. Now, I have to tell you, you know, that the big surprise for me in coming to Europe this year is I really feel the presence of Osho, the influence of Osho. I had no idea that this was the case. I mean, you know, I love, wherever I go, I love to see what's going on, what the spiritual community is like, who's doing what and who's here and what portion of the population is interested in those kind of things. And Europe has just amazed me that, when I look in, you know, I look at the magazines, the newspapers, and I ask people, and when I'm told about what's going on, it's very often the case that if you just look into it a little bit and trace back the inspiration for it, the influence or the source of it, it amazes me how often it's Osho. Osho, I really feel Osho in Europe in a way that that's not the case in the United States at all. So it's a joy for me to be here. And Osho had so many German disciples. So that it just there's something about German that it's klingt Osho für mich. You know, I just love it. So because so many of the people around Osho were Germans. So it has an association for me.
Yes, I think so. I have spoken with another person who had a similar biography as you, and she said the same, basically.
Yeah.
So the Germans and Osho went well together, and you guys seem to be...
Is she German?
No, she's Canadian, I believe. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know why this all happened in the 70s. So maybe there was a little bit of trauma in Germany after the war, or that brought the people then to India to search for liberation, because we grew up in a very depressive
world. Sure. Or maybe just they were smart enough to go to Osho.
I don't know.
No, well, you have to understand that I'm a devotee of Osho. You know, I'm not a disciple, I'm a devotee. So just to hear Osho's name is a great joy for me. So so just the whole association of Osho had so many German disciples. Just hearing a German accent or German spoken to me reminds me of Osho. And anything that reminds a devotee of their master is just heaven.
That's amazing. Yeah. There must be an amazing relationship between you and Osho. And in my case, this Jesuit's still alive, old man. I visited him a couple of times, but there's by far not such a strong relationship. Yeah. So, different stories, different experiences. Huh?
It just seems impossible, but it's so, you know.
Yeah, it is what
you
it
just,
is. Huh?
You're just left with the feeling of how could I be this lucky? How could I? How could this happen to me? You know.
Yeah.
And that's another one of the thresholds, by the way. That until a person has had a real experience of the true gratitude, which is much more all-encompassing than what people, I think, usually mean when they talk about appreciation or gratitude. There's many sincere, loving people who talk about how grateful they are to God for their family or their work or their life or whatever it is, but the overwhelming carry-you-away gratitude to the divine for everything, the fact that, you know, you can think, you can speak, you have fingernails. It's kind of all encompassing. You just flattened by, you're just overwhelmed with, how can it even be? And that level of gratitude, that experience of being carried away by gratitude, is actually one of the thresholds. And it's not a later threshold. It's not a high stage. It's just a stage that has to occur, because in that there's a humbling process, and that humbling process is absolutely required. So that you can even be more available to what the divine is trying to give. And until you are humbled more, you can't receive it, you know. You can't receive it. So many times when people are telling me reporting on different experiences or where they think they've reached spiritually, and they're talking about gratitude, I'm listening for is the gratitude indescribable? Is the gratitude beyond comprehension? Is your description telling me that you've really crossed that threshold or not? And if not, then great, that's yet to come for you. You're going to love it. So.
Yeah, and in my case, there was a tremendous gratitude at one stage. But this was also a trap, yeah? So it happened to me. I'm special, yeah?
Yeah.
Yeah? I just said, and not too long time later, recognized this is a trap. This is a terrible barrier.
But it's in terms of the experience of true divine gratitude, that's the only trap possible. There are no other traps for that one. Some thresholds have many possible traps. That one, there's only one, the one you're describing. So if you can climb out of that trap, you're fine.
And for that, I had to see that I do not exist as a separate individual.
Yes, And the best
The idea of a separate individual is just an idea. It's not real.
Certainly. And that is a complete antidote. But there's even another complete antidote, which is to see everything as God-given. If you can really even see the gratitude as God has given me this gratitude, no way your ego is going to co-opt that. And you're going to think you're so wonderful. You know? So if even that's a gift from God, because we do experience, you know, it's almost impossible not to experience as my gratitude, my overwhelming gratitude, you know. So, but the my goes right out of it as soon as you really get, really get it. Even that's from God.
There is no my. There is no my.
Yeah. Yes. But it's very difficult for people. Very difficult for people to get to the point where that is fully recognized, fully seen, fully experienced. So, you know, I'm a very, what's the word I want? I'm a very low goal guru. I'm happy if you just see it a little bit, you know. Many times I've been to satsangs or been, you know, with teachers who are very, very, have high goals for people. You know, unless you become enlightened, it's not good enough. I'm not like that. If you a little bit more trust, a little bit more recognize the divine is, a little bit more realize that you don't control as much as you think you do, I'm very happy. I'm very happy for every step along the way, because these steps don't happen for everyone. They don't happen easily. Often they don't happen quickly. Often they don't happen at all. So I'll take anything I can get.
And it has been the way has been walked by the disciples, fundamentally. Yeah. So it cannot be transferred as knowledge. Yeah? It has to be walked, so to say. Yeah.
Well, yeah, the guru can't do it for you, but the guru can certainly hold the flashlight and help you go quicker and more safely and more confidently. But if you have to go, the guru can take you to the door. That's it. The guru can take you to the door, but you have to be willing to walk through the door.
Yeah.
And that's the final barrier. The final barrier is, when that moment comes, the natural tendency is to run back, is to say it's too much, I can't do it, or to become so overcome with panic and anxiety and the most profound terror and fear that most people just go and turn back. What can I do to make this experience stop? You talked about it from your own experience, and you said you recognize that was your wisdom, that was the divine wisdom, that you recognize, no, I just have to pass through this fear. Well, that threshold for many people is the stopping point. They actually don't pass through. They didn't have the moment of insight you have, or the wisdom didn't come to them like it did to you, that however awful this feels, it's in my best interest to pass through it. Instead, they turn back. And that's where the guru really, really becomes the truest help, the final help. If the trust is really there in the guru, and the guru says, I know it's painful, I know it's frightening, but just pass through it. I'm holding your hand. Come with me. You'll be glad you did. You'll feel like you're being ripped to shreds. You'll feel like you're in hell. Who knows what you'll feel? It won't be fun, probably. If you're having a difficult time, it'll be difficult. But I guarantee you, it will not harm you, and you will be glad when it's over. And in that moment, the guru is really, really doing something that a person cannot do for themselves unless a lot has already happened. And most of us have not, you know, have not gotten to the point where we can self-guru, or where we can even coach ourselves in that moment to withstand the terror and go forward, or let it have you. So all the training, you know, the guru-disciple relationship is a training a training in surrender, a training in trust, a training in being willing for the unknown, and a training in withstanding whatever has to be withstood in the interest of truth, in the interest of reality, in the interest of God. You know, the understanding that if I really want to get there, there's a price to pay. Whatever that is, there has to be a pre-decision, a priori attitude of whatever it's going to be, without knowing what it is, I'm willing for it. You know, and that's a huge chunk of my work. A huge chunk of my work is people come to me, I see they're not willing yet. So then my work becomes to help you get more willing, to help you cultivate more willingness. Because usually people aren't willing because they don't understand well enough yet that there are no guarantees, there are no preconditions. Everybody's willing if you tell them, here's what's going to happen, and here's how you'll feel when it's, because that's what people ask. Well, how will I feel, and what will happen? And the answer is, who knows? I know that for most people it's like this, and for me it was like this. But I can't guarantee you it'll be that way for you. What I can guarantee you is that if you experiment with it, if you trust a little bit more, if you are willing to pass through it, the chances are very good not only that you'll be glad, but that you will benefit tremendously and be enriched tremendously and move forward toward what's really the divine in a significant way. But to do that, you have to be willing without knowing what you're willing for. You have to say, you have to drop the idea that tell me what's going to happen. You know, you can't have conditions. So very, very, very often the main part of what I'm working with a certain portion of people is how to be more willing, how to be more open, how to not be so clenched of like, just, I have to know ahead of time where I can't go. Actually, you can go, you're just not willing to go. So let's see if you can be more willing.
Just to underline this, I just can confirm again and again that when I had this pain in each cell, it was not done in one session. So that was this 20 minutes period, which was then stopped somehow. And I had to go to that point twice again. I did it on my own then, and the same pain came. Again and again. And then finally it was seen, it was all created by a thought and by a belief. And then it was done. Then it was suddenly done. So how could I believe this? It created pain. This belief was somehow created in early childhood.
The belief is about something that isn't real, but the pain is real. And fear is real. And the terror is real. And the anxiety is real. That's the problem. And, you know, if you have a guru and you're willing to trust the guru to help you through that, it's a tremendous advantage. It's a tremendous it doesn't have to be so imposing, you know. So, but for most of us it does have to be so imposing, because it's really goes against everything that came before. It's really a kind of a saying yes in a more powerful way, because we're actually saying, yes, I understand that it's terrifying. Yes, I understand it's painful. And even for that, I'm willing to say yes if it takes me to the divine, if it takes me to what's real, if it takes me to
This commitment is very helpful. In my case, this commitment was there in my case, but it was so unconscious that I needed a guru, so to say, and consider this session that I had with that lady as some kind of a coaching that just repeated one sentence that I had said, and chuck, the pain was full on. I was not even aware of it before. And that was enough. But that was the help of the guru in that situation, so to say. That's what the guru can do.
That's a lot more than coaching. You know, so it's just amazing that God gives us these possibilities, you know.
Suddenly it's there. Suddenly it can unfold.
Suddenly it can unfold. We didn't even have any idea that it was there either at all, or to the degree or the aspects of it, and that it can actually be overcome, or that you can go beyond it, or that you can actually arise into something better in a matter of minutes, hours, days. You know, usually the process you're talking about, when it's really when the right help is there and the person is open to it and the complete willingness is there, My observation is that it's usually a matter of days, a few days. Because sometimes, yeah. I do an intensive with someone where we're just together 24 hours a day, and, you know, they're using my guidance on how much to work on it in this moment, when to relax and rest a little bit. And whenever I've done that, the longest it's ever been was 4 days.
In my case, 3 days. Huh?
Yeah, and usually, typically, 2 to 3 days. I think 2 to 3 is the average. And if people just could accept this, that we're talking about a few days of pain, a few days of terror, a few days of feeling like you're being torn to pieces. We're not talking about you're going to have to feel like this for years. But the human mind always has the idea that if I feel terrible in this moment, what if it continues for the rest of my life? And nothing has ever continued for the rest of your life. In fact, most things that have been intense or difficult have actually only lasted seconds, moments, days, weeks, months at the most, and that's rare. But people never stop to observe their own life, how things have worked in their own life closely enough, dispassionately, scientifically, to realize most terrible things don't last very long. You know, yeah. the terrible part is over sooner than we think. It's the anticipation that it's going to last longer than we think that's so fearsome, you know.
Yeah.
But once you've figured this out once and for all, once you've seen it once for all, that's never actually been that bad because I've always actually gotten over it fairly quickly. It really is like an inoculation. It makes you much more willing for future moments in life that will, no question, be difficult.
Hmm.
You just relax about it. You know it's not such a big deal. But you know, you have to put this in front of people. You have to explain it till you're blue in the face, and then the next time they have a little crisis or something is difficult, if they're lucky, and if you're lucky, they'll remember it and they'll see it in practice in their life. They'll see that it's true, and then they'll have the understanding, and then they can move much more quickly.
Yep.
So you know, because the problem is we're on the clock. We're on a time limit, you know.
Yeah.
You have to get this done before you die. You only have till 1 second before you die, and you have to beat the clock. So people need to remember that this, you're on a time limit. You're on a time limit. If you want to get to God, you got to get there before you die. You got to get there before you die. So because there's no automatic going to God just because you died. People have this idea that, oh, well, if I never get to God, it's okay. Because when I die, I'll automatically go to God, or I'll automatically merge with the divine, or I'll automatically be in cosmic consciousness. And it's simply not true. It's just factually not true. The opportunity to go to God is what a human life is. You have to do it here. You have to do it now. You don't have the same ability after you're not in your body. So this is very hard. Unless people have had some direct knowing of that, it's very hard to convince them that the human life is the most auspicious, the most beneficial opportunity for coming to reality, for recognizing what is, for going to God actually. When you're dead, it's much harder, if not impossible, because you don't have the advantage of being able to focus your attention the same way. You don't have the advantage of a human body and a human mind and a human nervous system that actually allows you to move. You know, there's a move. If you're alive, you have the benefit of movement. And if you're dead and you're still in a, you know, not God conscious enough state, you will not be able to move. And that is a handicap. Then you'll be more, you know, watching what goes on instead of being able to move toward what you want to move toward. So this is very, very important to put in front of people that this life, not after you die, is the most conducive set of circumstances for going to God, for reaching the divine.
Yeah, but here I have a question, and maybe you have to go deeper into this. When we say God is all there is, we are never out of God.
Yeah, absolutely.
We just believe ourselves into a distance from God.
Mm-hmm. But you can take up residence in that distance, and you can pitch a tent in that distance, and suffer and believe some, in some, to whatever degree that you are not close to God or not part of God or not far. You know, I'm just talking about what the experience is. So if the experience, if the idea is that the experience comes automatically with the death of the human being, then mm-hmm. I just want to point out to people that that's an incorrect idea. It's not
the,
true.
The experience will not come then. I cannot yes. see how the experience could come after death. Huh?
Well, it can't. It can't. That's the point. This is your chance. This is your chance. when you are alive, you have the best possible circumstances for if what you want is to go to God or to find truth or to know reality actually, yes. then you have to do it while you're alive. It isn't going to happen automatically like throwing a switch just because you died. Because when you die, you're just going to be in the condition you were when you were alive and with less ability to go where you want to go because you can't move. You can't move. So unless someone has some either intuitive sense of this or has had some experience of an after-death state for real, it's very hard to accept this. I know that people... When I talk about this, I can see in people's eyes, they comprehend it, but they don't really accept it. So that's when I get very directive and very authoritative and I just tell them, I'm sorry, it's so, and I swear to you it's so. I can't prove it to you. I can't give you endless evidence other than my own experience and my own seeing, but I can tell you there's no question it's so. And if you are better off simply accepting that it's so because you need to do it in this life. So okay, anything that helps them.
Fundamentally, you clarify that there is no such thing as a path to God after death. Fundamentally,
no question that this is a pervasive idea people have. It's a pervasive exactly, yeah. idea, and
churches tell yeah, and
yeah.
bullshit,
and,
yeah.
and it is a toxic idea because it's a tragic idea because the opposite is true. You will not automatically go to anything. And second, this human life has been given to you so that you have the best possible opportunity to go to God. And that's how it has to be used. And a human life that isn't used to go to God is a human life wasted. And who wants to waste their life? And I don't want anyone to waste their life. So don't waste your life and don't sign on for this idea that it comes from many different sources that, oh, well, when you die, you automatically become more divine or you go to God or you enter some celestial realm or, you know, I swear to you, it isn't true. You know, Reinhold, it isn't true the way you're shaking your head. But most people have no sense of this. They actually have for so long been told and taught and really conditioned, really brainwashed into thinking that death is some kind of liberating event. And it's just not true. You know, it's just not true. The liberating event is this moment of life to be used in the right way. So this is the liberating set of circumstances that allows you to actually reach the divine. But you have to use it. You have to actually be willing to go now as you in this life at this time. And the clock is ticking, so you got a time limit. You have exactly until 1 second before you die. After that, game over. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty serious stuff, you know. I mean, we can say it non-seriously, but the person who's really still has the conditioning that, oh, well, when I die, you know, I go straight to God, they have to be convinced that it's not true, or in some way get to that understanding that it's really here, and it's really now, and it's really about this life is for that. And I get passionate about it. That, I mean, I really am trying to convince people because I know it's true, and it breaks my heart that people have this idea of, oh, I'll just wait, and when I die, it's all taken care of, you know? Because 1 minute after they die, they're in for a big shock, and I don't want anybody to go through that shock.
Yeah, because I assume, of course I cannot prove, but... At the moment, one can say we are in heaven or in paradise right now, right yeah. here, right now, and we always were, and we never could be other. Yeah? That's yeah. one way of seeing it, yeah? And we believe ourselves out of this, yeah?
Yeah.
of this knowing. Yeah?
Yeah, and even worse, you can make it into a hell for yourself.
So. Yes, because we don't believe that we are there, and then we start with this separation, probably created by the birth trauma and the following judgments by parents, you are not okay. Somehow this belief of being a separate individual is growing, and then the belief, I'm not right, I have to be afraid of being judged, and this creates hell, yeah, when this is on. But fundamentally, it's just the way it works, but it can be overcome. Huh?
Yeah.
And when you want to go to the divine, you see that this is all an illusion. That is fundamentally not true.
Well, if you're lucky, you'll see it. If you're lucky, you'll see it. Because everyone doesn't get there. In fact, I would say the majority who are sincere and really seriously on a spiritual path, the majority fall off at some point. It's tragic, but it's true. Or get sidetracked or get deluded into some other direction where they are no longer actually moving, where they have actually stopped going in that direction. So to actually be progressing, to actually be moving in that direction for real is to me, it's the greatest joy when I see somebody moving for real, because I know how rare it is. I know how much already had to be successfully navigated, because there's so many ways to fall off the path, you know. And even people 20, 30 years staunchly on the true spiritual path fall off. So the statistics are against you, but you should be in the smaller proportion that actually go. Sometimes I say this and people say, well, that discouraged me, that statistically my chances aren't good. But I don't let it discourage you. You be in the percentage that goes, not in the percentage that falls off. And then why be discouraged? But it's just like saying, you know, any difficult thing, anything that requires a lot of you, many people don't fulfill it, don't complete it. Not everybody who, you know, goes to college, graduates. It's like that. So if it's not the case, but let's just use it as the analogy. If it was the case that the majority of people who go to college don't graduate, and that's the actual statistic, if you hear that that's the statistic, you don't need to be discouraged. Just
be
determined that you'll be in the percentage that do graduate.
Yeah, sure.
And then there's no problem. And if everybody's in that percentage, even better.
Yeah.
So. I mean, I have a lot of respect, a lot of admiration for people who don't let anything stop them. That was really my story. But I had, you know, the most kind of grace-given devotion to Osho, so I can't take any credit for it. But when I'm talking about now, I'm really talking about those people who are not doing it through a position of devotion, who are kind of just so determined. It's a beautiful thing to see. But that's another one of the open secrets, let's say, of spirituality, that those who persist succeed. The really, persistence is the name of the game in the long run. What I advise people, if it's possible for them, is to make an a priori decision of that nature, an actual mental, you know, intellectual decision, but from the heart decision, but mean it. You can't just say it and not mean it, but, you know, take yourself in hand and see if it's so, and if it is, then recognize that it's so, that I'm not going to let, I want the divine for real, and I'm not going to let anything stop me. Whatever comes, it's not going to stop me. If that's your position, nothing is going to stop you, and you will reach. But it's very hard for people to accept that that's factually true in a sense. You can't say factual, but in a sense, factually true. Because very often they think they're persistent, and it's ego, it's self-delusion. They haven't really made the decision. They haven't really given their whole self to the intention that I'm going all the way no matter what. And if I don't get there, it wasn't because I wasn't willing or I didn't persist. And if you're persistent, you'll make it.
It's the all-in situation.
Yeah, all-in, exactly. That's a good way to put it. It's all-in. If you are not willing to be all in, then you are holding something back that prevents the real attitude of persistence that gives you a pretty much a guarantee, not an ironclad guarantee, not a 100% guarantee, because there's no such thing, but a 99% guarantee. 99% mm-hmm. that you'll be in that smaller percentage that get further. So, in fact, we have an MP3 file, a CD, one evening, you know, Darshan, that we titled The Path of Persistence. And that's the whole message of that one discourse, is that if you cultivate persistence, you'll get there. Mm-hmm. Everything else will take care of itself. First, you will decide to persist.
But that does not necessarily mean, in my case, it definitely does not mean that I left my ordinary life. So I'm working in industry. I have been working all that time. I did not go to retreats, with the exception of that one 10-day retreat.
You were all in. Persistence just means whatever is required, I will fulfill it. And the more persistent you are, the more you have that attitude, the less likely it is that existence, that the universe will say, let's test you. Let's give you the requirement that you have to leave your job for you to go forward towards God. If you're already all in, the universe really, really makes it easier for you. That's absolutely my observation. So it's to people's advantage to go all in. But it's very hard to convince people of that. Because they're always afraid, well, what if God requires me to leave my job? What if God requires me to leave my family? You know? What if God requires you to stand on your head for the next 50 years? I mean, all these what ifs are the ego and are gonna drive you crazy. Forget the what ifs and get clear. And by the way, I'm not willing and I'm not ready to have total persistence are valid responses. But get clear whether you are really willing and get clear whether you're willing to choose a priori ahead of time the path of persistence to say nothing's going to stop me and to really have that 100%. And if the answer is no, I can't do that or I won't do that or I don't want to do that, fine. But now you're not kidding yourself that you will persist no matter what, you know. So it's not required that you say yes. It's required that you not be deluding yourself, lying to yourself, fooling yourself. No is fine and yes is fine. But be clear and be honest. Don't be so willing to be fooled by your own ego.
Yeah, what I used as a guideline or some kind of an orientation, and this is also propagated by the Jesuit in the book. He says the relationship between you and God and the relationship between you and human beings, human people, are parallel. So I said, yes, I want to improve the relationship between me and human being, particularly with the family. Somehow I'm willing to invest in that. That was in the starting point. This all-in situation came a little bit later when I was really confronted during that retreat with that strong statement that hit me. But in the beginning it started very softly, very gently. But what is the contribution to improve the relationship with human beings? God was an abstract thing for me. I did not have a clue about what I should believe. I treated with Christianity 20 years earlier and surrendered because I just did not understand what they were talking about. It was too complicated. So we are talking here small steps, fundamentally. All in sounds so strong, but in the beginning it can be very small steps, but there come effects when you do every day a little bit. These long-term effects, they are tremendous. And it takes them 3-4 years.
That's right. And it may take 10. And it may take 20. And it may take 25. Or it may take 1 or 2 or 3 or 4, like you say. But Well, just like you say, these are small steps, but of course it's valid to say these are gigantic steps. Because this is how the mind fools people. This is how the ego fools people. Oh, it's just a small step, so it's not important if I don't take it. And the other thing that's
so important. Huh?
Yeah, it's required.
That makes the difference. That makes the difference.
100% and 100% the difference. And the other way the mind fools us is it says there's a feeling of, well, this small step, I know I should. I understand it so well, and I've thought it through so, and I feel it so much. It's the same as if I already did it. People kind of short circuit it, and they don't do it. So these are the two ways people kind of skip the small steps, and then they never get the insight. They never get the opportunity to see that what seemed like, oh, it's a small thing and I should do it, turns out to be life-changing, turns out to be completely transformative. So everything you're saying is exactly what people have to understand, or else they simply take the wrong turn, or they simply don't go forward because the ego fools us into believing this isn't necessary or this isn't important, and it's just not true. It's just not true. You don't know. We don't know what's going to change our lives inexorably and forever. The only mistake is to do nothing. The only mistake is do nothing. Only going, you know, if you go forward and you take a wrong turn, it will invariably lead you to the right turn, you know?
Yeah, one can have some trust. And interestingly enough, when I came to that retreat, there was a first interview, and the lady who accompanied me during that retreat asked the question, with which expectations do you come? And I said, well, I would like to improve the situation in the relationship with human beings a little bit. And immediately she said, drop even that expectation. Mm-hmm. Yeah? So do steps without any expectation to achieve anything. Yeah, because then you might be frustrated and go away. Yeah? So, and even the Jesuit writes in his book, when you sit for a meditation unit of 20 minutes or half an hour, and after half an hour, after that time, you have the impression that it was a terrible half an hour and it did not work out at all.
Yes.
That was a very good meditation. Yeah. So that is another hint of a state of mind.
Yes.
that can be helpful in my experience. Yeah.
Well, in everybody's experience, who's willing to actually try it, who's willing to be a little more experimental, a little more suspend judgment, and just see how it works or see what happens. So what I say to people very often, because people always are asking questions about meditation, so and it just amazes me that it's not better understood in general. If people will come and say, I can't meditate, I really want to meditate, or they'll say, you know, my meditation isn't working the way it's supposed to work. just what you're talking about. But let me say this here, because this might be helpful to a number of people who would see this broadcast. There is only one appropriate measure for the person. You yourself can only use one appropriate measure for whether you succeeded in your meditation. For example, if your meditation is supposed to be for 45 minutes, let's say, you succeeded if you did your meditation for 45 minutes. If you had the experience you expected and you did 45 minutes, you succeeded. Not because you had what you expected, but because you did it. If you have completely different experience than you expected, if you have a terrible experience, but you did the meditation for 45 minutes, you succeeded. The only measure of the successes of a meditation is, did you do the meditation? Not what happened, not what did you experience, not how did it feel, not what do you think about it, not what do other people say about it. Did you do it? Because the real ultimate barrier is we know what's right, we read what's right, we study what's right, we listen to what's right, in our heart we know what's right, and we don't do it. So, but it applies to meditation. If you do the meditation, you succeeded. If you do the practice, you succeeded. If you practiced what's right for you and it didn't work out, wrong. You succeeded. It didn't work out doesn't mean you failed. If you practiced it, you succeeded. The result isn't the measure. The measure is, did you do it? Because the number one problem of spiritual life is we think it, we believe it, we feel it, we hear it, We intend it, but we don't do it.
Hmm.
So that's why the guru often has to be tough with people, has to kind of shake them a little bit and say, all right, you know, because people come and they talk about, well, this happened and that happened, I'm this going. And the guru at a certain point with some people, if they're ready, if the guru knows it'll be okay for them, says, okay, finish. Enough. We're not going to talk anymore. I don't want to hear about it. Either you're going to do it or not. And I tell you, do it.
Mm.
So people love to talk.
Yeah.
I love to talk, but doing and talking are not the same. And this is another, it's another way the ego fools us. We talk about it so much, we kind of almost think we did it, even when we didn't do it.
Yeah.
So, you know, you have always the potential to completely deceive yourself if you are being the one who's evaluating. We cannot evaluate, from a spiritual side, we cannot evaluate ourselves. It isn't even valid usually to evaluate, but if there's any evaluation or any assessment that has validity, it can't come from us because there's no way for us to be objective. We're in the wrong position to make a proper assessment. And again, that's part of the function of the guru is to make a proper assessment. And if it's appropriate to in any way share that with the person, then fine. Usually it's not even appropriate or necessary. But if it is, then it needs to be an outside source that can be objective because people have to accept that there's no way for you to be objective. And people are running around day and night assessing for themselves and thinking that there's validity in that. And telling them a story, I failed at this and I succeeded at that and this happened and this didn't happen, but it should have. It's all imagined.
It's all the crap, yeah. That's the crap that leads you off.
So the guru...
Eliminating this way of working, yeah.
The guru is always saying, "Stop believing what you tell yourself. Stop believing what your mind is saying to you about more than anything about yourself, because by definition, it will be inaccurate. By definition,
yeah.
If it's you talking to you about you, by definition, it's inaccurate.
It's just." The trap talking to the trap about the trap.
But this is the real situation for most of us until we either have gone far enough or have surrendered enough or have experienced enough or know better. You know, it's our situation until it isn't. But for most of us, it's the situation. So yes, it's absurd. Yes, you can laugh at it. But people are really trapped in this like quicksand. It's, you know, like quicksand. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, if someone's trying to help pull them out, they're fighting off. Yeah, get away from me, you know. It's amazing how we fool ourselves. It's one of the greatest human capacities, self-deception.
In the Bible, I believe there is a sentence, the beliefs can relocate mountains. that's the this effect of believing and deceiving. Hey man, we have spoken for more than 2 hours.
I could talk to you all night. You're such a sweet guy. You have a lot of passion and a lot of what's the word I want? You radiate a kind of a happiness. I love seeing that in anybody. I love that. So you're giving people a lot, no question. If you're doing these broadcasts on a regular basis and people get to see your face, you're probably giving more than you realize. That when you do this broadcast, I understand they see me or whoever you're interviewing, but they see you too, right? You're on the screen.
What I normally do, and maybe I should change because you are not the first person who says that, I normally show my face briefly in the beginning, and then I show the partner's face all of the time. Yeah? But
you might want to consider a split screen or the partner's face maybe two-thirds and you one-third, because believe me, you have a lot to say, and it's true. And but there's also something you radiate that's very wonderful, and the more people can get that, the better for all of us. So, you know. Okay. I mean, when I see a beautiful person in front of me, I speak up. I say, hey, do you even realize how much you're giving? You know, how much what you're radiating?
I have no idea.
Well, then take my word for it. I'm a card-carrying guru. Take my word for it.
So you are my guru now, and then I.
I didn't say that. You are radiating a very beautiful energy of divine happiness, openness, and acceptingness. You are just by your being, by your presence, by what's in your eyes, by the energy around you, you are delivering a message of acceptance, willingness, humility, and the possibility for real happiness. So that's a great gift. That's a gift that you are meant to share with people. That's why you do these broadcasts, because God wants you to give this gift. You are giving the gift of whatever who you're interviewing has to give, but you also are giving a gift. Okay?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Just accept it that it's true, because it's God's grace that you have that to give.
Thank you. Maybe you have another one. I don't know what happened.
I hope so. I would love to. Tomorrow, anytime. Anytime you want. Get in contact with us and we'll make it happen.
Okay.
Or if people I don't know if you've ever done this, but the other possibility is to work with people directly. If you have people with you who have questions, like how we do, like satsang, and you know, because one of the things that we do that not everyone who does what I do does is we just work with people directly in the moment with whatever they bring, and that's a divine process. I can't take credit for it, but it's something that when other people witness it and they see what's possible, how much transformation or how much positive change is possible in just a few minutes, if the person is willing, that's a powerful testimony. It helps people be more willing. So if you are ever interested in doing something like that, I would love to do that. That's what we do at Satsang. That's what we do at Online Satsang. Whoever wants to be worked with is always always invited to raise their hand, and then they come up and we sit together and they bring whatever they want to bring, whatever the issue is, whatever the situation is, and we just explore it. We just see how far we can get with it. And very often those are just beautiful divine moments where people are able to just drop what they need to drop or understand what they need to understand. Or it's always so amazing to see people transform in front of your eyes. And then when people in the audience or watching online see that, it gives them...
Confidence.
Yeah, that's the word I was looking for. It gives them the confidence that this is possible. I see this person actually transform. Maybe I can. Maybe what I thought is not possible for me, or what would take me 10 years to deal with if I'm serious about it, maybe I can actually deal with it tonight. Maybe I can actually deal with it this week. Maybe what I thought I could never overcome, I actually can. Because look what they did in 10 minutes or 5 minutes or 20 minutes, you know, whatever it was. And, you know, not everybody who I work with transforms in front of people's eyes, but many do. And this becomes a powerful, powerful proof to other people who are more hesitant, more full of doubt, more not really yet established that the divine is real and that existence will help you if you're willing to be helped, that the support is actually there. It can be in the form of someone like me. It can be in any. It can be a book. It can be someone like you. It can be your own family. It can be a stranger you meet on the street. But it's not something that everybody really either understands or accepts, that life has all the support, all the love, and all the assistance that you need if you're actually willing for it, and if you actually are willing to say yes to it. You have to say yes to it. You can't just say, I hope it comes, and then when it knocks on the door, you won't answer the door. You have to actually extend yourself and say, okay, I'll take it. Help me. And it's a beautiful moment when people do that. That's a big part of my job is to, that's what I think God meant when he said, make yourself available to people spiritually. Really, the essence of it is those people who are ready for that moment, who want that moment, some of them you're going to be able to help and do it if you can. Mm. So that's, it's so beautiful to watch what happens for people. People, every human being is such a rich, multi-dimensional, phenomenal, divine, fascinating phenomenon going on, and to see that actually climb higher in front of your eyes, open, expand in front of your eyes. Oh my God! You know, it's just the miraculousness of it. It's like eating and drinking. It's so enjoyable. You know, it's just
bliss.
It's so satisfying. Because you know this, I don't have to tell you. You know it's possible for the person. You know it's possible for every intact person, and it's just such a shame that the person is, so many people are believing I can't, or if I only had help, or, you know, people choose to be victims instead of stepping forward, you know. So sometimes you have to just convince people. Just once, step forward, and let's see what we can do. Okay. Yeah.
That's what it is. And
that's my job. I have to do my job.
Okay. Hope we did a little bit of the job tonight.
No, a broadcast like this, a big, not a little bit, but big contribution, because this way, instead of a room of 50 people or a room of 10 people or a online meeting with 20 people, I assume more than that kind of number will be able, are likely to see this broadcast, and maybe something here, even if it's one little thing, one sentence you said, one thing that becomes their own insight and makes a real difference, then it's invaluable. It's invaluable. It is a numbers game. It's really a numbers game. Can you say enough to enough people that something takes hold for someone that really matters? Really matters.
I was so surprised recently. I have contact with an older man, and met him about 3 years ago, or 2 years. 2 years ago, and we had such conversations. So he somehow is in this mystical environment. And recently he said something changes in me, so I'm not forced to do anything anymore. So I'm getting relieved from tasks. And he said it's related to something you said a long time ago, when you said you are not living your life, but your life is being lived. So you never know. I said, I do not even remember that I said.
That's right.
But to him, it had meaning. So I don't know how that works, but that's it.
Once he was ready, it transformed his life. Those stories are always tremendously beautiful. And it's happening all the time between people. Between people, it's happening all the time. So you don't know. You don't know. I don't know. You don't know. Nobody knows what interaction you have with somebody, what you say to somebody, touch somebody's hand, that 20 years from now, it changes their life. This is why all the traditions always talk about let go of the result. This is one aspect of that is this is another part of how you can't, won't, and don't control anything. You never know what the result of anything you take. You don't know what the result of it will be. And people have this idea that they know that they know the result. The result is, I did this, therefore, that will happen. You don't. If they really would be willing to suspend their belief and just really look at it intelligently and scientifically and objectively and think it through a little more clearly, I don't see how you can come to any other conclusion than you don't know, you can't know, you won't know. Even if you think you know, you don't know what's going to happen beyond that. And if you're not willing to admit that, then you are closed-minded. One of the problems with spiritual life and serious, sincere spiritual seekers is most of us have the idea that we're very open-minded, especially compared to more conventional people, that their closed-mindedness is very obvious, even to each other sometimes. But the spiritual seeker is often the most closed-minded because it's like, I know what I know. And really, until you can admit you know nothing and there's no way for you to know anything, you are not really open-minded.
And
until that's not just an idea for you, but a living reality in you, until that's your day-to-day experience, you are probably fooling yourself. Your ego is fooling you if you tell yourself, oh, I'm a pretty open-minded person, you know. Because if you're really open-minded, you have to drop everything you ever thought was true.
Yeah.
By the way, that's another threshold. if you have not gotten to the point where you have realized that everything you ever thought was true isn't, then that threshold is yet to come.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
That's clear. That's no belief system whatsoever. Not even believing that it's not true.
Yes.
Not even that. Not even that.
Well, knowing absolutely that there is no way for you to know.
Yes.
Not possible.
Yeah.
Okay, I think you're getting tired, so we'll stop.
Yes, you are right. It's getting dark outside. You can see probably in the background of the room.
Yes. Okay. Well,
thanks again. If you put it up, it will probably appear on YouTube somehow. Yeah.
Oh, okay.
So let's see.
Okay.
If another one will happen, yeah.
I would love it. You're very fun to talk to. I would love it. Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Cheers, then. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.